talk to somebody who's trying to calm me. Get somebody in charge here.
I am in charge.
I don't
here.
Want to talk to some flunky pig trying to calm me.
You don't have to be calling.
What's he
pig.
Doing?
And what do you get back
what
over there?
What are you over there for?
What do you What's get he... back there? Huh? Get back
What's
there.
What's he
what
doing? Look at him with him.
Get over there.
Go on back there, man.
Get over there. What you?
He wants to kill me so bad he can taste it.
Oh, God, I was going to kill him.
Erica!
A famous scene from the classic 1970s movie Dog Day Afternoon, starring Al Pacino. Later in the show, we're going to speak with two documentarians who spent years following the real guy who inspired Pacino's portrayal in that Sidney Lumet film. By the way, he never said Attica. But first, online security. A Russian crime ring has apparently stolen 1.2 billion usernames and passwords and more than 500 million email addresses. It's been called the biggest hack ever. So, should we all be freaking out? Well, maybe not. Russell Brandom is a reporter for the website The Verge, which covers technology, science, and culture. And his story on the breach is out today. It's called The Russian Hack of the Century Doesn't Add Up. Welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. And before we get into why you're so skeptical about this and the story, is anyone disputing the fact that this was a large-scale attack by Russian hackers?
I would dispute the attack part. I think so the interesting thing, if you read the report from Hold Security closely, they say, you know, we've been tracking this group, they tried a variety of attacks, and they ended up with this stockpile of 1.2 billion sort of login password combinations. Now, it's sort of unclear how they got them. I mean, it could have been a series of attacks over several months is sort of the implication, but I think the idea, if you hear 1.2 billion passwords stolen, you imagine kind of this big raid, and it's sort of like, well, they've been doing this for a couple months, and the list kept getting longer, and then eventually we got the list, and it had 1.2 billion names on it.
Yeah, so you mentioned Hold Security, and this is the company that revealed this information that was the basis of the story that was first in the New York Times. Can you tell us who Hold Security is, what the company is?
So they're this Milwaukee-based firm. They did a lot of good work on the Adobe problems earlier this year. They're a fairly reputable firm, and most of the work in data breaches like this is done by private firms like Hold. But I think a concern that a lot of people have with stories like this is they're sort of a single source. They're our only source for information about this particular hacking group. And their main motivation in this seems to have been to get people sort of concerned about the hack and then to sign up for their breach notification service, which is the only way to get more information about this group and sort of this particular stockpile of passwords.
Oh, so you have to pay to find out if, in fact, your password was stolen?
Yeah, and this is one of the things people have been concerned about. Kashmir Hill, writing for Forbes, said, you know, almost immediately after it went up, you know, wait, if you go to their site right now after this big exclusive story broke, they're saying pay us $120 to, you know, for our breach notification service and we'll tell you if your name's on the list, which, you know, it's a little sketchy. I don't think it's what the Times had in mind when they published this story.
And then what were these Russians apparently doing with this information? Why do they want it?
So this is one of the other puzzling things. They normally, if you get a hack like this, Target's a good example. You know, there are a lot of things you can do with the information. If it's credit cards, you can try identity theft. You can try to, you know, use it to break into people's bank accounts. Or you can just, if you want to keep your hands clean, you can sell it to other criminals who will use it to do those things and sort of they'll assume the risk. They're not doing any of those things. According to the Times article, they're using this to hijack social media profiles, Facebook and Twitter, and spam people, which is really not a particularly lucrative or sophisticated thing to do with this kind of information, and suggests that what they have has maybe kind of been around the block a few times.
Well, it's lucrative in the sense that they would sell these to companies who then spam you, right?
Well, no, I mean, they would be trying to, you know, if Russell Brandom, my name, is one of these 1.2 billion names, then, you know, they're going to look at that and say, oh, well, we know what kind of passwords he uses. Maybe we can take over his Twitter account, spam these links to these sort of bad websites. And then, you know, out of all my many, many Twitter followers, some of them maybe, you know, they trust me, so they click on the link and they end up at the place. But that's, you know, you have to do that a lot to get any kind of serious money out of it. And I think it's not a very valuable thing to do with a password, and it's sort of not the first thing you usually do with it. But I also think it's good news for people who are worried that they might be on the list that, you know, the bad thing that might happen to you in this case is not really that bad. It's, you know, you're going to have to write into Facebook to sort of get your account back maybe, but, you know, it's just a small chance that you'll lose control of some social media account. It's not these people are trying to break into your bank account and take all your money.
So how can you find out if you're one of those who they got without paying the $120?
Well, that's the thing. I really don't feel comfortable recommending that people do that. And I also don't think it really matters. I think that this is one of the more low-impact hacks, and I think probably this information is not – I don't think people should be worried that they're on this list.
So it's not like the Target hack, which you mentioned earlier, which happened in December, and 40 million credit card numbers were stolen, 70 million addresses were stolen. And that was a big issue, and a lot of people were worried because that went directly into their financial security, because these hackers could then use this information to get access to their bank accounts and steal their money?
Absolutely, yeah. Well, and I think one of the other odd things about it when you compare it to other hacks is in the Target hack, it was this very sophisticated method. They ended up, you know, they broke into the security system of the people that were installing air conditioning for Target, and then that system gave them access to Target, sort of the cyber equivalent of crawling in through the air ducts. And I think the weird thing about this is it does seem, on some level, it's an unprecedented hack. It's 1.2 billion accounts. That's a higher number than we've ever seen before. But they weren't trying anything particularly new or sophisticated. It's sort of these very basic attacks that I think any serious security professional would know about and protect against. They just sort of tried a lot of them against a lot of different places. So they scanned, you know, 400,000 websites as part of this. And it seems like it was really the small sites that didn't really have their security up to date, and I think places where it wouldn't really matter if they got hacked anyway in some cases.
Russell Brandom, reporter for the website The Verge, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
We just talked about involuntarily sharing information on the internet, but, you know, we voluntarily give away lots of our personal data if it suits us. We post all sorts of stuff on Facebook, of course, and there are also fitness and diet tracking apps which rely on us sharing our information about our bodies. Well, now there's an app for the soul. You can use your smartphone to keep track of your spiritual health. PJ Vogt and Alex Goldman are here to tell us about that and some of the other internet-related stories bouncing around the information superhighway. They host the WNYC podcast, TLDR, and that stands for Too Long, Didn't Read. Hi, you guys.
Hi, Madeline.
Hey.
Let's talk about Soul Pulse. What is this?
I just found out about this week because Casey Sepp wrote an amazing essay about it for The New Yorker. But the idea is it's supposed to be an app that quantifies your level of spirituality. And the way it does it is actually pretty simple. You sign up, you fill out a very brief survey, and then twice a day it will just ping you and have you fill out a very quick questionnaire. Sort of asking about various variables, but one of them is how spiritual you're feeling in that moment.
And what's the point of it?
For a person, I think what is interesting about it is the idea that you might start to get feedback on, if you're a spiritual person, this thing that's really important to you, but you don't think of as like something that you can put into metrics usually.
But yeah, that's the whole question, I guess, around it, is how do you quantify something like that?
Well, Casey, who wrote about it, and who is, I'm not a religious person. She is a religious person. What she seemed to say was that paying attention to something, having an exterior thing remind you to look at it, that was already helpful, and that she did start to notice sort of weird things that she wouldn't have noticed otherwise. Stuff like that she traditionally had always prayed before meals because that's just like a thing people do. Mm-hmm. But that the app told her that after meals, her sense of spirituality seemed to decrease. So she started praying after meals.
How did it measure the decrease in her spirituality after the meals?
It asks you.
Huh. Well, what does it ask, though? Do you feel spiritual? Do you feel close to God?
Yeah, 1 to 10, how spiritual are you feeling? I think, like, the easy version of the story is, like, an app comes up against something that obviously is, like, bigger than our ability for an app to come up against. But if you don't think of it as a tech thing, you know, it's sort of just like a prompted journal or something.
It's like reminding you to be mindful.
Yeah.
To just take a break.
Yeah. And I mean, if you're entrusting your entire spiritual life to your phone,
you're spiritually bankrupt. Or, and this is a great way to segue into our next topic, which might be the opposite of the soul pulse. And this is an app called Push for Pizza.
Do you want us to elaborate on Push for Pizza? Because there's not much to elaborate on. You install an app, you press a button, it finds the nearest pizza place near you, it offers you currently cheese or pepperoni pizzas.
No breadsticks.
No breadsticks, unfortunately, and no other variety of pizza. And then you decide how many you want, and then you order it, and that's it. The idea is that it's a one-button pizza ordering app.
Because the buttons on your phone, there are too many buttons on your phone to push to make a phone call.
But yeah, that's what is crazy about it. It's like there's a whole group of people who've decided they never want to have a phone conversation with a restaurant again. But even those people, previous to this week, still had to go through the process of looking through various online restaurant menus and making choices. It's just a pizza button in your house.
I do want to talk about the promotional video for it, and here's a little clip from it.
I want pizza, but I don't want to order a pizza.
I wish there was like a button, you know, and all you have to do was push that button and then pizza comes.
Wait, say that again?
Yeah. I wish I had a button I could push for pizza.
A button you could push for pizza?
Yeah, yeah, like an app. And it's just got one button on it.
And that one button?
Pizza.
Pizza.
Just one button, and you push it.
Push it for pizza.
Okay, I got to stop it there because I think we get it. And so it's three guys, and then one guy, he exhales some smoke. So I think there's a message there of who the audience is.
Yeah, I think this is like a four stoners by stoners invention. And what's so weird about this whole slew of single-use apps that we've been seeing is they seem like they're in on the joke of how absurd they are, but then they also want to make tons and tons of money.
I
and
think
they sort of
they
do.
Want to make their pizza and eat it too.
Oh, sorry. I mean, the joke itself is the selling point.
Yeah.
The novelty of it is the selling point. So, yes, they're in on the joke. But the joke itself is what makes people interested in it in the first place. The novelty is what brings it attention, therefore makes it valuable.
Yeah, it's like punchlines as a business model.
Okay, let's talk about this other one, Leak. It's an anonymous way to email somebody. And I guess they took a wrong turn in their PR outreach because they sent these anonymous emails to journalists and they were a little bit offensive. Can you talk about that?
Well, I have no way of proving it, but I received an email that I think was from PJ earlier this week about how I smell via the Leak app.
Leak guarantees their users anonymity, and I wouldn't want to get in the way of their promise. Definitely was me.
The idea with Leak is that you can send sort of whatever you want as an anonymous message, everything from sort of the mundane to the profane. And journalists started receiving emails via Leak that were part of a promotion to try and draw attention to it, but the emails were kind of unsettling. They were things about people finding you attractive in the workplace. They were things about people who wanted to tell you that they made more money than you, I believe, was one of them. I make more money than you, but I just don't know how to tell you that. And it was all things that were kind of contextless and just felt like people actually sending kind of upsetting things via the app. And
but in general, how are these kinds of apps received, these kinds of anonymous message sending apps? Because I would imagine, given the internet and what happens, that once you're guaranteed anonymity, all sorts of foul things can fly loose.
Yeah, and they tend to. These apps don't promise the kind of anonymity. They don't promise high-minded anonymity. Like if a court wanted to subpoena where a Leak message came from, I don't think Leak is implying that they wouldn't immediately roll over. It's unlikely that, you know, an Edward Snowden would use it. They're kind of just apps that let people be jerks to each other anonymously. I mean, I'm sure there's other use cases, but generally, that's what these things get used for.
I think the difference between this and something like Whisper, though, is Whisper is just like a way to send a message out into the ether, whereas Leak is a way to send like a really pointed, directed message at another person to let them know exactly how you're feeling about them, whether it be positive or awful.
Well, I look forward to receiving my next anonymous email from you guys. So
PJ's pretty good at it, or at least he's, you know, cultivating a personality on there. So expect something from him pretty
Excellent.
Soon.
It'll
wait.
Be nice. It won't be like the stuff I send Alex.
All right. PJ Vogt, Alex Goldman, producers for WNYC's On the Media, and they host the podcast TLDR. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thanks.
All right. If you had an app that could do just one thing with the push of a button, not ordering pizza, what would it be? Give us a call, 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, and we may play your comment at the end of today's show. Coming up on the program, why the White House is redacting key portions of a Senate Intelligence Committee report on CIA torture. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, we're going to have to wait a little longer to find out what's in a Senate report on torture by the CIA. President Obama has supported making a summary of the report public, and last Friday, this is what he said about it.
In the immediate aftermath of 9/11, we did some things that were wrong. We did a whole lot of things that were right, but we tortured some folks. We did some things that were contrary to our values.
But senators and the White House are still arguing over how much of the report can be released. Senator Dianne Feinstein, who chairs the Senate Intelligence Committee, says the White House is redacting too much. In a written statement, she said, certain redactions eliminate or obscure key facts that support the report's findings and conclusions. And she's refusing to release the report until some of the White House redactions are removed. Greg Miller is national security reporter for The Washington Post, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, the report has not been made public, but some information has been released, has been leaked out. What do we know about what's in the report so far?
We know the broad contours of the report. We know that it's really harshly critical of the CIA and that it reaches a number of fundamental conclusions, including that the agency repeatedly misled the Congress, the executive branch, as well as the public about the severity of the interrogation techniques that it used, as well as the effectiveness of those techniques.
And this was during the Bush administration.
Right. This was an interrogation program that was created when the CIA captured its first al-Qaeda suspect in 2002 and went on for 4 years. And those prisons were basically emptied out by President Bush in 2006. A bunch of detainees were transferred to Guantanamo Bay. But President Obama officially ended the program in 2009 when he took office.
Okay, so he does support releasing at least the summary of the report, but he has redacted key portions. So what has been redacted?
Right. And so when you refer to a summary, I mean, in this case, we're talking about a full report that's over 6,000 pages and a summary that is 500 pages. So this is even a summary. It's a document with a lot of details. So what has been stripped out, according to the sources we've talked to, is a lot of references to pseudonyms of CIA officers who played roles in various parts of this program, as well as details about those officers. And so the agency has really argued, look, you can't include these details that would enable outsiders, including foreign governments, to piece together who these people are and possibly seek retribution. What Dianne Feinstein is saying is that they have stripped out so much detail that it undermines the report itself and its conclusions. It has gone beyond sort of protecting those officers and now actually sort of undermines the case that the committee is making that this torture, these interrogation techniques didn't work.
And so where does it go from here if there is this standoff and she's refusing to release the summary until the redactions are redacted? What happens next? Does the White House now decide what to do?
Well, I mean, this is a report that has been, you know, underway for 5 years now. So what happens next is sort of what has happened until now. It's just more waiting for the delivery of this. I think everybody believes that this report is going to be released sometime in the next month or two. But they are now down to fighting over the final details of what might be excised or deleted. So she is sending a letter to President Obama listing the committee's demands, the material they want restored. I imagine the White House will look at that and see whether they can live with it. And so there's this, we're in this final negotiations stage.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Greg Miller. He's a national security reporter for The Washington Post, and we're talking about a Senate Intelligence Committee report on torture by the CIA detentions after 9/11. Now, another dispute related to this is the revelation that the CIA basically spied or hacked into the committee's computers during the creation of this report. And CIA head John Brennan has apologized for that. He's admitted to doing it. Two senators are calling for him to resign. So is this also fueling the standoff between the White House and this committee?
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, it is fueling it, and it's also symptomatic of it. I mean, it reflects the tension and the friction over this entire endeavor by the committee, this long-running investigation into this very sensitive and very controversial period in the CIA's history. And what it all really is about, I think, is, you know, this is a document that could serve as the essential kind of historic record, the one thing that's out there public on this program. And the agency wants its version of history to be reflected here. So you're right. So that, you know, the suspicion and the animosity between the two sides has been really off the charts during this process. And at one point, the CIA became suspicious that the committee had slipped in beyond the boundaries on this computer network that they shared and grabbed documents they weren't entitled to. And so they basically set up an operation to figure out how they did that. And as we learned this past week, now admit that their own security staff looked at committee staff's emails, looked at documents that were in the committee's possession, and ventured into an area on that shared network that was supposed to be the exclusive domain of committee investigators.
And where are the Republicans on this? It seems like a Democrat versus Democrat fight.
Not entirely. I mean, you have other Republicans like John McCain, whose own history, personal history in Vietnam, informs his position on this interrogation issue. And he is adamant that this report should see the light of day. Oddly, the many Republicans on the committee voted in favor of releasing this report, even though they try to argue that they don't stand behind it and really weren't involved in its production. And this was a Democratic staff endeavor almost exclusively. And once the Republicans decided they didn't want to be a part of it early on in the process, they were kept out of even being able to review drafts until the very end.
And tell us more about President Obama's balancing act here, because these interrogation techniques did not take place under his watch, and yet he is being accused of being too protective of the CIA.
Right. I mean, and this is a dilemma for not only the president, but for John Brennan, who is now the CIA director, but was previously President Obama's closest kind of national security counterterrorism advisor. So on the one hand, they want to come out and President Obama staked part of his initial presidential campaign on this idea that the United States went too far in the war on terror, too far in the war in Iraq. And now, you know, he wants to be consistent with that position that he took. But at the same time, he has to worry about not only just the morale of the CIA, but the fallout from the release of a report that is just going to spill out lots of damaging and incredible detail. You know, these harsh, excruciating scenes of interrogations that were carried out by the CIA. I mean, this really could have international implications. I've heard CIA people I've talked to say, look, the reaction overseas in the Arab world and elsewhere is going to, there's a potential that it could be extreme. It could reignite this anti-Americanism.
Right. And so we don't want to see that now, I guess, with what's happening in Iraq and in the Middle East in general. So it is a very delicate time.
Right. On the one hand, you want this reckoning. You want this to sort of examination, this searching examination of what the United States did. And as Feinstein has said, the whole purpose of this is to be sure that the United States doesn't do it again. But at the same time, the war on terror is more complicated now than it was when Obama took office. And you have to consider all these other eventualities.
Greg Miller reports on intelligence for The Washington Post. Greg, thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the 1970s movie Dog Day Afternoon was a sensation when it came out, about a man who robbed a bank, held the employees hostage, and then held police at bay for hours, all because he wanted money for his lover's sex change operation. It's based on a true story. We're going to find out more about the real dog after this news update with Larry Perel.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Sidney Lumet's Dog Day Afternoon is one of those quintessentially New York 1970s movies. It stars a young Al Pacino in one of his best roles, a guy who robs a bank to pay for his lover's sex change operation. But the whole thing goes south, and it turns into a hostage situation and a media circus.
You're a city cop, right? Robbing a bank's a federal offense. They got me on kidnapping, armed robbery. They're gonna bury me, man. I don't want to talk to somebody who's trying to calm me. Get somebody in charge here.
I am in charge.
I don't
here.
Want to talk to some flunky pig trying to calm me.
You don't have to be calling.
What's
pig.
He doing?
And will you get back
what
over there?
What are you moving in there for?
Will you
What's
get
he
the
doing?
F- back there?
Huh?
Get back there.
What's
will
he
you?
Doing? Look at him with him.
Get over there.
Go on back there, man.
Get over there. Will you?
He wants to kill me so bad he can taste it.
Oh, God, I was going to kill him.
Erica!
Al Pacino's Sonny Wirchick is one of film's most lovable antiheroes, but Dog Day Afternoon is based on the true story of John Wadowitz. Wadowitz is certainly a larger-than-life character, and he's really not quite as charming as he is in the movie.
My attitude is, I'm from the old school, and I'm old-fashioned Italian, I'm a male chauvinist pig, and I'm the f***ing boss, and I run things. You don't bug me, I don't bug you. You bug me, we have a problem, and that's it.
Alison Berg and Frank Carradine spent years with Wadowitz, and the result is their new documentary. It's called The Dog, and they're here now. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, you spent 10 years making this documentary. Did you think when you first started that you would be spending so much time with the dog?
The plan was a year, so things didn't really go as we expected. But yeah, we ended up spending... I mean, we were at the apartment of the dog and his mother on a daily basis for years. And the result is that we ended up with a film that went much deeper, is far more complex than we ever expected. So we're happy with what turned out.
The second we got in touch with him, we knew this was not going to be just like about Dog Day Afternoon, that it was truly like a character, like a real character that we had found who had an incredible story.
Talk about the first time you met him. What was that like?
Close. It was from the second we met him, he grabbed Frank's crotch, and then I thought he was going to shake my hand, but instead he grabbed my hand and sucked one of my fingers down, you know, to the knuckle, and then immediately sat down in a. We were in a diner, and so we sat down in this booth, and he had this, you know, brown plastic bag with him, and he starts taking out all these naked photos of his girlfriends, you know. Boyfriends, girlfriends, all of his lovers, and starts telling us amazing stories of his life and talking really loud, and people are looking over. And this went on for 8 hours. We actually had three full meals with him, I think, that day. And it never stopped.
The reason I call myself a pervert is that I'm sexually oriented. It's very easy because you got to look at it this way. Most people drink, most people smoke, a lot of people do drugs. and they have sex. So they have all these outlets. Okay, I don't smoke, I don't drink, I don't do drugs, I don't gamble. So I'm an angel. But I got horns. Okay, and the trouble is when you got horns, you only can do one thing. Okay, and that's...
He's just so unfiltered, and the way you see him on camera is the way he was in real life. So for those of us who haven't seen the movie Dog Day Afternoon and haven't seen your film, tell us what happened that day in 1972 at that bank. So prior to that day in 1972, the dog's wife, Liz, had tried to commit suicide and was in a hospital. And he was told that Liz was not going to be let out because Liz wanted a sex reassignment surgery. So he decided to hatch this bank robbery idea so he could get the money for the sex reassignment operation. So the idea was he'd get the money, he'd break Liz out of the hospital, and they'd get on a plane and go somewhere. So he gets two accomplices, they get to a bank, they think they're going to get out, and instead they get caught and they're surrounded, and it becomes a 14-hour hostage crisis because they've got a bunch of the bank tellers inside the bank, and this goes on all day, all night, until the early hours of the morning.
The more visible bank robber is 27-year-old John Wojtowicz, an out-of-work New York City resident and an admitted homosexual who left his wife and two children 3 years ago.
As the whole thing unfolds, it sort of captures the nation's imagination. Here's this guy who's also saying why he robbed the bank, which they're shocked because it's 1972 and no one's really heard of this before. And so that's what Dog Day Afternoon captures, is a day in the life in the sense of the bank robbery and as it unfolds.
And then it also captures the spirit of the 70s at that time, because at least in the feature film with Al Pacino, he is this hero in some ways. He gives pizza, orders pizza for the crowd. He throws money at them. He yells Attica in reference to the prison riots in Attica. It's really an anti-establishment, anti-hero.
Yeah, it's the little man against the system. You know, there's that whole mantra that he played into, as one of our characters says, which is, you know, he was doing this for somebody else. He wasn't trying to rob a bank to have money to go to the Bahamas or anything. John was also part of sort of a political group that was the Gay Activist Alliance.
Homosexuals who acknowledge their homosexuality and pattern their lives accordingly are known as gay. And the gay liberation movement is challenging a society that abhors homosexuality. The Gay Activist Alliance is the largest and most vocal of several homosexual groups.
So it was the beginning of the 70s, the beginning of the gay rights movement. You know, so there's a lot of meaning attached to the robbery. In real life, it's not quite as simple as that, perhaps. I mean, John was also a guy, he'd been in Vietnam. His life was sort of falling apart. He was trying to find himself. His relationship with his lover might have been falling apart too at the time. So
we should also add that his least favorite part of Dog Day Afternoon is Attica, Attica, and waving that white handkerchief, because mm-hmm. he never said that. And it's the most famous line of the movie. And whenever something's not really about him, he's not happy.
If you're just joining us, I'm talking to Alison Berg and Frank Corradrin. They directed the new documentary, The Dog, about the real man and real events that inspired the movie Dog Day Afternoon. His name was John Wojtowicz. So here's a man with prodigious appetites.
Yes, we talk about his appetites a lot in all forms. Yes, yes.
So sexual, you meet him, the first day you meet him, as you say, he's sort of coming on to both of you at the same time. And so what was your assessment of his mental state?
What was interesting is there were days, it was never always the same person in a way. And I'm not saying, oh, this is a guy with multiple personalities, but there were a lot of different layers to him. And so I think that first day, for example, when let's say you show up and he's grabbing you and he was sort of manic and funny and engaging, but at the same time, it's just, you know, you want to take a couple of steps back. So it was fascinating. And then you also realize, okay, but this is like a guy that has no sense of consequences. So sometimes it could also be like a little more difficult, because you really never knew what was going to happen with a guy like that.
But also I think that, you know, he likes to test you and he likes to push your buttons.
And I'm just wondering about his role in the gay movement at that time. He does attend meetings and he does do a political act where he marries his lover, who's Liz, the one he wants to get the operation for, very publicly, and sort of making a statement with that.
Ernie bought the most expensive dress he could find on Grand Street. It cost like almost $1,000. So he could look regal and drive what we call all the butch numbers crazy. So I said, well, he'll get over that bullshit.
Did he see himself as a political activist for gay rights? And how did the gay rights movement see him?
I think there were much, you know, like smarter people at the Gay Activist Alliance and people who would have thought things through. Whereas John was the guy who was like, no, I believe in marriage. I want to marry the person I love. I'm just going to do it. And, you know, that's charming when it's a wedding ceremony. It's less charming when it's a bank robbery. But he was that guy. But I don't think he was, you know, one of the main people at the Gay Activist Alliance.
And he was sexually motivated. I mean, he says that the beginning of it for him was that he wanted to go there and get laid.
I met people. I liked the people. And we had sex. And then, like, around 71, I became more active. I went to more meetings, okay, because I would meet a lot of people, but they were more politically oriented than sexually oriented.
As far as how he was viewed by the rest of the people there, I mean, I think he had sort of a wild personality. People knew of him. But once he committed the bank robbery, I think it went more from scratching their heads to really being like, this is no poster boy. This is not who we want representing us. So I don't think that they were happy about that. I think that now, all these years later, what some people are thinking are, look at the fact that he had zero shame to say who he was and what he wanted.
So then it all ends up, as you expect, he's arrested, he's sent to prison, and then Liz gets her operation. Somehow she gets the money.
Warner Brothers.
Oh, yeah. From the movie.
Yeah.
While he was in prison, the film Dog Day Afternoon came out. And now, because no one could pronounce Wadowitz, he's called as the dog, and it's almost cemented, like, this is his character, this is who he is. So when he gets out of prison, he tries to kind of make the most of it.
So he tries to make money off the fact that he was this famous bank robber. Signs autographs in front of the bank.
Yeah, but you know what's interesting there again is I don't think he was trying to make money. I don't think he was getting any money for any of that. I think to him, what he really enjoyed was being the center of attention.
Mm. And he did try and get a real job. I mean, he offered to do bank security at Chase.
He did.
I'm surprised that they said no.
Shocking.
But it seems like that was the height of his life, right? The high point of his life. And even going to prison would be part of that, I guess. And then after that, he doesn't really do much.
No, he never did. I mean, I think also, you know, with the dog, it was a mixture of, he just was not somebody, I think, who would have held a job. He did have some sort of mental issues that were very borderline. So it was never clear whether it was like, this is the life he chose or he just couldn't have done it anyway. But I think perhaps, maybe, you know, like when we showed up like 15 years later, that's why suddenly he loved the attention so much, because it was like, oh, now I get to like tell my story again, you know.
And so you end up spending 10 years with him, and I find it taxing to spend an hour and a half, 2 hours with him, watching him. I mean, that's a lot of energy. It's really intense. How did you deal with 10 years with him? How did you handle that?
Well, in real life, we spent 4 years with him. He passed away while we were filming.
Okay.
You know, yeah, it was tough at times, but there were moments that, you know, we knew we were capturing such a unique character. And the times that he would drive us crazy, it was kind of, you come back to that this is a story that we wanted to be the ones to tell.
So he died 8 years ago of cancer, and so he never got to see your movie. Mm-hmm. Do you think he would have liked it?
All the parts with him in it.
No, I think he would have loved, in a way, when we were shooting, you know, he said in the beginning, he was like, well, I want, because he would archive every single thing about himself. So he was like, I want a copy of each tape. I want 2 DVDs. I want this and that and blah, blah. But he never asked to see what we were shooting. And it's almost as if he didn't care. It was more the you know, putting him on camera and calling him all the time and seeing him all the time. Also, while we were making it, I mean, quite frankly, you know, we did this in our spare time for 10 years. It wasn't, we were we both work in film. We were making a living, trying to make money to make this film. And it was just like there were long stretches of time where it didn't even feel like we were making a movie. We were just sort of like living life, and he was part of it.
Also, it is this incredible stepping back into time into 1970s New York, and it just, it felt like that was a completely different time in the sense that something about 1970s New York is unique in just the sheer insanity of what was going on. I mean, there was so much going on.
Yeah.
It was almost anarchy in parts of New York, parts of this country. So what did it feel like being immersed in that era now?
Yeah, I mean, you know, when we met the dog also, it felt like there were things about him where you could tell this guy was from another era. Like, he didn't have an answering machine. He never had a computer. You know, I don't think he ever looked at the internet in his whole life. He was just from another time. His deal was like, he was very, like, you know, street smart in a way that, mm-hmm. I don't know, it's just really, he had the 70s, like, stamped all over him, right?
He never got out of the 70s.
No, yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy to do it.
That's Alison Berg and Frank Rajan. They directed the documentary The Dog. It'll be in theaters this weekend and on demand on the 15th. Such a good documentary and such a good feature film, Dog Day Afternoon. It's one of my
film.
Favorites.
Yeah, I look forward to the documentary.
Yeah, it's definitely well worth seeing. He is more outrageous than the Al Pacino character, for sure. So, Warren Olney,
hard to believe.
What's happening at 1 o'clock?
Well, we are going to be talking about an interesting paradox in the automobile industry, particularly regarding GM. You know, they had all these recalls,
yeah.
Record number of recalls because of the ignition problem. Toyota had the same thing, only with unintended acceleration, as they called it. And yet, the car business is going through the roof. And the question is, why? And are people not paying attention? Or do they figure that the new cars are all that much better than the old cars?
So demand for even GM cars is
up? Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Yeah. They're doing better than ever.
Well, we'll talk about that at 1 o'clock on To The Point. Thank you, Warren
Olney. Okay.
And on this program, remember those lawsuits against Hollywood directors and producers alleging sex abuse of minors at parties? Well, those lawsuits are being dropped. That story is next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Michael Egan, the man who accused director Bryan Singer and three others of sexual abuse, is expected to withdraw the last of his lawsuits against them today. It's not clear yet whether that's the end of Egan's legal fight. You may remember that back in April, Egan, with his mother by his side, held an emotional press conference in which he claimed he'd been sexually abused at sex parties. These parties allegedly took place in Hawaii and California in the late 1990s when Egan was a minor. And joining us now is Jonathan Handel. He's entertainment and technology lawyer and contributing editor at The Hollywood Reporter. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline.
Well, remind us again about the details of his accusations.
Well, sure. And the details are that he alleges that he was sexually abused by four individuals at parties in 1997 and 1999 in both Los Angeles and Hawaii. Now, the hearing you referred to is happening today, really right now probably, in Hawaii, but it actually probably will not result in the withdrawal of the suit. Mm. Egan has moved to withdraw his suit, and it is the last of the suits by Egan against these four individuals. But Bryan Singer's lawyers have told me that they will probably oppose that withdrawal.
Why would they do that?
Because they filed their own motion to dismiss, and the difference is that Egan's motion to dismiss would be, quote, without prejudice, which is a legal term that means he could refile it, whereas the motion, of course, that Singer has filed, if granted, would be a dismissal with prejudice, meaning not only that the case couldn't be refiled, but it would provide a stronger foundation for Singer to then bring a malicious prosecution action back against Egan and also Jeff Herman, his lawyer, should they choose to do so.
Hmm, I see. So it's lawsuit versus lawsuit. It's quite complicated. There are a lot of lawsuits. In fact, Egan has filed at least 8 lawsuits against Singer and the 3 others you mentioned.
Well, he filed 4 lawsuits against Singer and the 3 others. He then filed 4 lawsuits against anonymous defendants in California. Those lawsuits appear to be against those same 4 because the allegations track the allegations in at least portions of the other lawsuits, the Hawaii suits. But he never has named who these additional 4 anonymous defendants are. So technically, we don't know that they're against the same people.
And he's withdrawing all of them?
No,
the
anonymous ones he's not withdrawing. And in fact, although Egan filed his motion that's being heard, you know, part of which is maybe heard today, pro se, in other words, representing himself, he actually has new counsel who may step in. So it's and they're very aggressive counsel. They are a law firm that specializes in sexual abuse cases, and they may indeed decide to pursue these cases in Los Angeles. We simply don't know at this point.
And we don't know why he's moving to withdraw those other 4 lawsuits.
Well, we don't know for sure without asking him, and he's not been available and probably wouldn't tell us, but the sequence of events is fairly telling. What happened was after he filed these suits that contrary statements that he made 10 years earlier started to come to light. Sworn statements and depositions in an earlier sexual abuse lawsuit that he had brought against the owners of the Los Angeles house, he said several things. One is he said he had never been to Hawaii, whereas now he, 10 years later, 2014, he sues 4 people for allegations in Hawaii. Second, he said that no one other than the 3 people he was suing then, back in 2000/2003, had sexually molested him. And yet now he sues 4 totally different people. And then thirdly, he had also signed a statement, I believe under penalty of perjury, that one man, David Newman in particular, had never sexually molested him. And yet 10 years later, Newman was one of the 4 people that he sued. In addition to this, several of the defendants introduced evidence in their motions that included things like credit card receipts, business records, things of that sort, sworn statements from their assistants who would have booked their travel, those kinds of things, to show in their view that they were never in Hawaii during the relevant period. So in the wake of all of that coming out, we started to see these cases apparently collapse. Egan started withdrawing the cases, and Herman is now withdrawing as Egan's lawyer. Mm-hmm. Jeff Herman and Michael Egan came into town in a blaze of publicity, standing room only press conferences, when they announced these lawsuits, and now we see sort of the opposite, that as quietly as possible, Herman is trying to withdraw. Egan is opposing Herman's withdrawal. He's saying, I don't want you to withdraw, even though Herman is saying the attorney-client relationship has broken down, and I can't even talk to my client except through these new lawyers. So it's a bit of a jumble.
Yeah, it sounds like
meanwhile,
a big
meanwhile,
mess.
It's important to note that Garth Ann Sear, one of the other people who was sued, has already brought a malicious prosecution action against Egan and Herman, and that action is pending.
So meanwhile, while this is all wending its way through courts, there are real reputations on the line and a lot of money on the line here in terms of publicity for Hollywood projects and these men's livelihoods. So have reputations been sullied forever? Or?
Well, reputations have certainly been affected by this. There's no doubt about that. I mean, Singer withdrew from publicity. The suits were filed shortly before Singer's latest X-Men film came out, and Singer withdrew from the publicity campaign for that film. Fox distanced itself a bit and said, "Look, this is something that Singer has to, it's a personal matter. Singer, he has to resolve and so forth." And the other individuals involved as well are feeling that their reputations have been affected. And Sear said in a Facebook post that he doesn't necessarily expect to be able to get any money were he to prevail against, at least against Egan, who may not have money. Herman may, if he were to prevail against him. But that what he's really looking for is a verdict from a federal court that would restore his reputation. whether that's whether that's the underlying case and whether that's attainable is a different question.
All right, Jonathan Handel, entertainment and technology lawyer and contributing editor to The Hollywood Reporter. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks very much, Madeline.
Well, Jolie Myers is on a much-deserved vacation, and in her stead is Andrew Walsh. Hello.
Hey there, Madeline.
Back from a much-deserved vacation.
Yes, I'm back from Cleveland, as a matter of fact, but enough about
me. All the glamorous spots.
Yes, exactly. So, let's talk about the feedback we got during the show today. Earlier on the program, you were talking with the guys from TLDR podcast of WNYC, talking about that single-use app that you just push one button and a pizza comes to your door from the nearest pizza shop. So we're asking the press players today, if you had an app that could just do one thing with one push of a button, what would it be? What would it do? Carolina says that she would make one that stops people's automatic sprinklers from working. Have you thought about this at all? Should I put you on the spot, by the way?
I haven't, but you can put me on the spot.
Yeah? Where's your brain on this?
It would deliver me a cute, furry kitten.
Oh, you would have so many kittens so quickly.
So many. I'd be one of those cat ladies in a second.
Oh, my gosh. We had a heck of a lot of people who were saying teleportation. Amanda was the first one who tweeted that at us, but a lot of people were like, yeah, just get me out of here with one push of a button. I thought that we should develop one that just one push of a button and you find the nearest parking space, because you don't have time to fiddle with your phone while you're
An app for that.
One button,
and it's
though?
Illegal.
One button.
But anyway.
All right, last one. Count Alexander makes us all look selfish by saying his app would bring about world peace.
Oh, I still want the kitten. Okay, Andrew Walsh, thank you for that. If you want to weigh in on that, you can. Our Facebook is KCRW's Press Play, or you can tweet at us. This is a perfect tweeting moment, at KCRW Press Play. Or an all-knee, To the Point. Up next, I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.